From an early age, I was sort of fascinated by medicine and numbers. They were my favourite things. Obviously, it gives you the choices. Do you want to go into medicine or do you want to do public health? For me, the advantage with public health is that if you get it right, you can make a population-wide impact. So you can have a bigger effect than looking after one person at a time as you do in medicine. So it's such a large-scale activity.
That was Dr. Mary Schooling from the CUNY School of Public Health. And welcome to Making Public Health Personal. This podcast is brought to you by the CUNY Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy in New York City. I'm your host, Laura Mioli-Farragon, Academic Technology Specialist at CUNY SPH. Each episode of Making Public Health Personal focuses on an aspect of health and social justice that affects our daily lives. We'll learn from expert faculty, researchers, alumni, and students on how public health policy, advocacy, and practices can benefit our ever-evolving community and our world. You don't have to work in healthcare or have a PhD to understand these topics. We're going to break them down for you and give you practical tips to make a difference, big or small. Today's guest is Dr. Mary Schooling, here to talk about identifying accurate research for those of you like me who aren't researchers or physicians. Dr. Schooling is chair of the Department of Environmental Occupation and Geospatial Health Sciences. She teaches classes here at the CUNY School of Public Health on quantitative research methods and PhD level courses related to epidemiology and the role of science in public health. Dr. Schooling is also an associate editor of the International Journal of Epidemiology. She has published over 400 academic journal articles related to her research, including topics that explain patterns of disease and identify new interventions for population health. We've got lots to discuss with you today, Mary. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
So I want to start with what is the most prevalent and immediate example of doing research today. As many people know, that's around COVID-19 and the COVID-19 vaccines that we're seeing go through clinical trials, and then they go through CDC and FDA approval. A lot of people who aren't researchers, including myself, find it difficult to know what information to trust. So, Mary, what goes into the research process for scientists who are developing these types of vaccines and coming up with the guidance?
Right. Well, I think that the research process has, in fact, been going on for years because people were preparing for these types of infectious diseases even before they came and developing generic type vaccines. So that sort of scientific preparation has been going on for a long time. What's happened with COVID is once people had amended the vaccination prototype, the vaccine prototypes as it were, so as to be suitable for COVID-19, then we've got to check that they really work and they don't have any side effects that could be harmful after all. So that's the key process that we should be interested in from the point of view of, you know, do we want to have the vaccine or not? Has that really been done properly?
So what are some different types of research methods that can be practiced?
So in public health, we've done an awful lot of observational studies where we compare people according to different attributes. That's worked really well for some things. For example, it showed us that smoking causes lung cancer. Mm-hmm. We just compared the habits of people with and without lung cancer, and we found smoking was really important. But the problem with this sort of research is that it's difficult to identify what's the key item that matters. For example, I'm sure if I went and had a look in New York, I could see that fur coats are associated with living longer. Mm-hmm. But that could be an effect of the fur coat, but more likely it's an attribute of the person wearing the fur coat. They're rich enough to have a fur coat and rich people live longer. Mm-hmm. So it's always separating out whether it's an attribute of the person or it's really the item that we think we could intervene on, you know, by say giving everyone a fur coat to see if they live longer. So that's always the problem. And that's why nowadays researchers are beginning to take advantage of more natural experiments to test causality, to test whether something really works.
And what do you mean by randomize?
If you're doing a randomized controlled trial, you're often, say, comparing some sort of intervention in one group or another. And to make sure you have a fair comparison, first you recruit the people. then you randomize them to the intervention you're interested in. So there's nothing that's influenced their receiving the intervention. There's no cause of it. It doesn't depend on anything apart from the play of chance. Mm-hmm. And so then you can see the true effect of the intervention without any other biases. In a randomized control trial, the only difference is that the person is randomly allocated to the intervention we're interested in, say the COVID vaccine, mm-hmm. or not. So we know that if we see a difference when we follow them up later, it's due to the intervention, say the vaccine, and nothing else.
Okay.
Now, with a natural experiment, we may not actually randomly allocate people to the intervention, but we may take advantage of them having a naturally occurring difference, which isn't related to external factors. So an example of that that we're beginning to use a lot in public health is naturally occurring genetic differences, which are not, which are sort of randomly allocated at conception. So they're not really related to other characteristics. And then using them as a proxy for some of the exposures we're interested in to find out their effects on health.
So you did some research on salt and cardiovascular health. Would someone having a likelihood for heart disease in their family be one of those variables?
Yeah, we could do it like that. You could look at whether people who are genetically more prone to cardiovascular disease have any other attributes. But for the question about salt, we were more interested in it the other way around, as to whether salt actually causes cardiovascular disease.
Okay.
And then we used naturally occurring genetic variants associated with having higher salt in the body and looked to see if those genetic variants were also associated with having cardiovascular disease.
So how do you make sure that the person in your trial isn't just eating a ton of chips or salty foods? Do you have to like isolate them or?
Well, it's the functionality of your genetic makeup in creating proteins. So people have different physiological processes, which naturally mean they have slightly higher or slightly lower levels of salt in the body. And we are just looking at the genetically determined salt level, which isn't affected by what the person has eaten. That's the whole beauty of it.
So the nature, not the nurture.
Exactly. You're just using the nature bit. Thank mm-hmm. you.
So how can we identify accurate information when we're looking at different studies? I know you have a lot of great studies and there's a lot of information out there. How do we know the good from the bad? What makes a good study and what makes a not good study?
Obviously, we can get information from studies where we've just observed people, but there is more risk of getting information that might be biased. So that the most reliable information as a basis for public health action is likely to be a randomized control trial, because then we've really tested for certain that the intervention does make a difference without any extraneous factors. And particularly if it's a large trial conducted ideally in both men and women, so we can check that it works in both groups and in different ethnic groups as well, so that we're not just trying to generalize from white men to the rest of the population, but have actually tested it in everybody and with a convincing result, then we know it's a good basis for action.
Okay. So I'm thinking about the example of maybe our 9/11 responders, people who were either firemen or construction, were told that it's safe to be there, and then now are having all kinds of health issues. How do you study that group at all?
That brings up a difficult problem in research, because you want to understand the course of disease in a group that's had a particular exposure or in patients. But those studies don't really have a control group of non-patients or non-exposed. So then it's very difficult to work out. Or you've got no comparison you can make, because you don't know what would happen if they hadn't been exposed or if they weren't patients. So those sorts of studies are difficult to interpret in terms of working out cause and effect. They're perfectly okay if you want to understand the natural history of disease, then mm-hmm. studying patients is great. If you want to describe what happened to the people who were in 9/11, then you can do that with a sample of people who were there. But to find out whether everything that happened to them was due to 9/11, you need to compare them with a similar group of people who were not in 9/11.
So maybe comparing them to another group of firefighters, for example, in another big city, would that be a way to do it?
Yeah, it'd probably be the best you could do, but it would be a good idea. You know, you must have a control group if you want to understand the differences.
Yeah, because there could be so many different factors. Just anything could really play a part in that, I understand. So you're saying that the problem with studying 9/11 first responders is that we're only studying the survivors of 9/11.
Oh, yes, that's a really interesting problem that people haven't thought about as much as they might. I'm not quite sure why not, but a lot of times what we're interested in is diseases of older people, because those are the ones that are the major causes of death, cardiovascular disease, cancer, those sorts of things. And the problem with studying those diseases is that you recruit people when they're old to study the disease, because otherwise there's nobody, there's no cases, but you're missing everybody who's died already because of something else. So if you do a study where you recruit survivors and you're missing people who've already died because of the exposure you're interested in, and some other ones who've already died of the disease you're interested in, or some other cause of death that means they never got to have that disease, then you can't see the true effect. And an example of this came up with COVID, that the early studies in COVID showed that smoking apparently protected people against COVID.
Protected them?
Yeah. I mean, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
But that's what the data showed. And that's a really good example. And there's subsequently been a big study that says, no, of course, smoking doesn't protect them. But that's what came out at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And the problem was that the people who get COVID, and particularly the people who die of COVID, are pretty old. Mm-hmm. So that group of people are actually missing the people who've already died of their smoking and the people who've already died of something else before they had the chance to get COVID in old age. So therefore, you can't see the true harmful effect of smoking on COVID in that group.
Because they already could have had lung disease or something and already passed away before COVID came around.
Yep. Lung cancer or cardiovascular disease, because smoking gives you cardiovascular disease. So that's where you have to be very careful in these studies, which are not experimental. If you do a randomized control trial, you don't have this problem, because although you recruit survivors, you randomize them after you've recruited them. So the survival no longer matters.
Got it. So there's a lot of information out there from drug companies themselves. That's usually the first data we see. Mm-hmm. And it may seem that they have a financial interest in presenting data that's favorable for their drug. That could be just a suspicion, but how is the research that drug companies conduct regulated to ensure the results are ethical and accurate?
Well, drug companies often do a lot of trials. So there's a lot of regulation around about trials to make sure that they are done in a fair way. So first off, you shouldn't even do a trial unless you're not sure about whether your intervention works or not. You know, you can't do a trial of something that's known to be harmful, and you wouldn't get ethical approval to do so, or not usually, or not very much. So first off, that should give some protection that you're not trialing harmful things. So that's the first step. And secondly, when you're doing a trial nowadays, you have to register the trial in advance, and it's not seen as valid or publishable if it's not been registered. And that means a drug company has to specify exactly what they're going to do in advance. And then when it's finished and the results are published, you can double check that they really did do what they said they were going to do. And that has helped reduce sort of misinterpretation of results.
Who approves these registrations?
They're on a website. I don't think they are approved per se. You can write what you like. But the thing is, everybody else can read what you've said, so they know what you were supposed to have done. I mean, that's different from the ethical approval. Obviously, there's specific committees that always oversee the ethics of a trial, and there's safety and data monitoring committees, but that's more to do with ensuring the trial is conducted in a way that protects the people in the trial, mm-hmm. as in terms of the running and the reporting of the trial results, which is where, you know, you could try and make it your product look better than it is in some way, then the trial protocol specifies exactly what was supposed to be the primary result and how the analysis was supposed to be done. So if a trial, the primary outcome is A, and a different primary outcome is reported, then you know that something went slightly wrong because, mm-hmm. you know, maybe A didn't turn out as they wanted, so they've reported B. So that's the whole point of the trial registration. It makes that process transparent so that the trials get interpreted correctly.
So we know what they were going after in the beginning. We know their intentions. Mm-hmm. And then if it comes out different, they have to say that.
Yeah, or you can, if they don't say that, then you can just look up the trial registration and write back the letter to the journal saying, oh, look, this is the outcome they've reported, but actually they were supposed to report that other one where there was no effect.
Okay, so they can omit data or...
They can do it slightly differently from what they said, but you can find out that they've done that.
There still is accountability for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still issues in that the trial might be designed in a way that makes it slightly more likely to get a particular result. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't want to find something harmful, you could make your trial a bit too small to detect a harmful effect. Mm-hmm. Just by saying, you know, I only need to enroll this number of people, but if you'd enrolled another 500, you'd have got a different result. So it's not a perfect process, but it's, you know, it's improving all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I mean, if the government had to do all the research for every drug, it would never get done. So we have to give some leeway to the companies to do their own research. And then for the CDC, FDA, or whatever other organizations there are to check that. And for the researchers, or even just people like us, to just be able to go and check that data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are initiatives for the actual trial data also to be made available to any researchers. So that's a further check that you could redo the analysis of a trial if you really wanted, though it might take quite a long time to get access to the mm-hmm. data to do that. But those things have also, you know, more and more sort of open science type initiatives to make the process of science completely transparent and reproducible.
So what advice do you have for people who want to do their own research on health related topics but aren't researchers?
Probably the most straightforward thing to do is to rely on evidence from randomized controlled trials and always to look for that on any particular topic. Ideally, with hard outcomes, did the person have the disease or not have the disease? Because that's mm-hmm. easiest to interpret. And, you know, large ones giving you information about men and women, maybe several that have been combined together into one overall analysis. Those are the best sources of information, and that's what goes into the guidelines, you know, which are written for how to treat and manage certain diseases or to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. Those mm-hmm. are all based on these sorts of guidelines, which are based on the randomized controlled trials.
So where would we find these trials and this data? Would it maybe Google Scholar or?
Well, Google Scholar does have a lot of stuff. The one that I think is more reliable because it's maintained by the National Library of Medicine is the one called PubMed. And then you can easily search and find trials on your topic. And then you just need to look for the one that seems to be biggest, most recent, and best conducted.
Great. So these kind of criteria that you mentioned about diversity of our subjects, making sure it has a control group, and looking at in a place like PubMed or Google Scholar, somewhere that is providing the study itself and not just taking someone's word for it or looking on Facebook or social media, but actually finding that data yourself and looking at it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I suppose the other thing that is a brilliant source of knowledge, and because it's sort of curated in some way, can be reasonably reliable or is a good starting point, is you could always look on Wikipedia. And then follow through to the references they give. Sometimes they're not 100% accurate, mm-hmm. but at least it will give you an overview And then you helps you work out where you might want to look further to check things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So always double check the source of whatever information. That's why the studies themselves are really helpful, because that is the source of the information.
Yeah.
And also just asking your own doctor. If it's a health concern that you have, asking your doctor is the best way to get some information about it.
Yeah, and that can be a great source.
Well, thank you, Mary. And thanks for listening, everyone, to the Making Public Health Personal podcast, presented by the CUNY Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy in New York City. I want to give a special thanks to our very first guest, Dr. Mary Schooling, and let you know that all of the resources we discussed in this episode are available in the description below. If you're interested in being a guest on one of our future episodes, feel free to reach out to me at laura.farragon@sph.cuny.edu. To find out more about the CUNY School of Public Health, you can visit us on our website, sph.cuny.edu, or connect with us on social media. We're on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search CUNY SPH. This is your host, Laura Mioli-Farragon, signing off. And while public health has a global impact, that doesn't mean we can't make it personal.